starting from Rosh Hashanah and going through Yom Kippur, we have a period of time that's called the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance. And even though Rosh Hashanah has a character all of its own and Yom Kippur has a character all of its own, nonetheless, they both belong to the same fabric of time. They both belong to a period of tshuva. And what that means is that somehow that the repentance that we are involved in Rosh Hashanah is different in substance than the repentance that we are involved in on Yom Kippur. And since today we're talking about Yom Kippur, we do need to have some sort of a sense of the ways in which those things are different. We've discussed this a number of times from a variety of different standpoints. We've spoken about the fact that on Rosh Hashanah, the relationship that we confront is a relationship between king and subject, between sovereign and someone over whom the authority of that sovereign is applicable. So the questions that we ask ourselves on Rosh Hashanah and the repentance that comes out of asking those questions revolve around such issues as, have we coronated the Almighty as sovereign in our lives? How far, how much, how extensive? In how many places is God boss? And in which places have we excluded him? What places have we reserved for us to be boss? And we may say, by the way, that theoretically, God is sovereign all over. But what we're talking about is, practically speaking, where is the Almighty final word? Where is he commander? And as long as there are parts of our lives that we have reserved in which we think ourselves to be a better judge or our judgment to be the normative determinant, then to that extent part of God's kingdom has not yet been claimed. We need to ask ourselves, how well are we involved in his service? Which begs the question, what is our service? We have, each of us, a unique contribution, one which cannot be replicated by any other living being. The Almighty's brought us into life for each of us to make a unique contribution. Do we understand that contribution? And if we do, then are we doing it? How well are we doing it? Could we be more effective? And to the extent that we are not more effective, then the tshuva that takes place is a tshuva that has to do with the character of that service. We make resolutions that are hopefully more consistent with what it is that we believe or think we should be doing in deference to the divine will and God's sovereign command. We ask for his blessing for the coming year. We ask for life, we ask for good health, we ask for the resources that will enable us, the wisdom that will enable us to carry out our resolution. The emphasis in all of this is really pretty much on the resolutions that we make, and to the extent that we find ourselves inadequate or falling short, we regret our shortcomings in as much as those shortcomings are a barrier between us and what we are supposed to be doing for the master of the world, for the King of Kings. If we were to have to identify what is the main affect, what is the mood of Rosh Hashanah, it would probably be Yira. It would be one of fear and trembling. One of awe. We stand in the presence of the monarch of the universe. We know that we are being judged. We know that we have to answer to that judgment. And we quake and we tremble that our response should be appropriate. The tshuva of Yom Kippur, as we have already spoken many times, involves a whole different relationship. Not less exacting, and not one that involves less tension, but of a different tone. The relationship over here is between ourselves and the heavenly parent. We talk about Avinu, we talk about our heavenly father. We talk about the fact that that we beseech his understanding for our frailties, his forgiveness for our wrongdoing, his indulgence and patience for those parts of which are rebellious. But we talk to him not as a subject to a king, but as a child to a parent. And here, what we're really answering to is the disappointment of a parent that we have not lived up to the loving expectations of the parent. So here what we're really talking about is the fact that our wrongdoing has distanced us, that it has taken us away from the caring, the loving, the infusion of strength, all of the things that come out of being close to a parent. And we go through these lists of al-chayt, the sin which we committed by being haughty, the sins which we committed by being stubborn, or by being stingy, or by being miserly, or by being disrespectful to others, whatever. So within this context, everything that we think about within the realm of tshuva is one that deals with our sorrow and our sadness at having created this distance, and God's sadness at having lost contact, or at least an intimate relationship between himself and his children. If we were to have to identify the main affect of Yom Kippur, it's not fear and trembling, but love. We are trying to re-engage a relationship which is rich in the feelings that flow between a parent and a child. We also spoke about the dynamic of forgiveness. Why does it work? After all, people do things which are not really revocable. We commit wrongdoings that we cannot call back. And much of what we do, there should be no way in which we could retrace our steps. If we speak ill of somebody else, and we damage somebody else's life, we can go and we can ask them forgiveness. And then we can turn around and we can ask the Almighty for forgiveness. The fact remains that that person lives with the ruins that we have created. There's very little that we can do about really reclaiming his life or her life for them. And there are numerous other things. But in general, how does one understand this dynamic of kapara, of forgiveness, of slicha, mechila, and kapara, of atonement? So in the past, we spoke of it in the following way. That inasmuch on Yom Kippur, that we engage the Almighty from the standpoint of our being his children, this is not a metaphor. This is a realistic definition. The Almighty has breathed the sanctity, the integrity of himself within us. We have a neshama. There is something in every human being. There is something in every descendant of the patriarchs and matriarchs, which is unique in the sense that it is immortal, that it is deathless, that it is timeless, that it is not subject to time or to space, that it transcends all of the boundaries and the limitations of the finite world with which we're familiar. There's something that soars above all of those things, and we call that the neshama, call that our soul. The essence of that soul is something divine. And by definition, it is incorruptible. What we are saying when we define ourselves in that way is that when we commit a wrongdoing, that what we have done is to have heaped schmutz over the surface of a very precious gem. We have clouded the luster, the brilliance, the luminous qualities of this divine soul. We've created barriers between ourselves and God. We've created barriers between ourselves and people. We've created barriers between ourselves and ourselves. The point is that the neshama, which is otherwise such a dynamic, vibrant organism, is now constricted, and it's constricted by all of the stuff that we have placed around it. There is what they call an agla. There is a crust. We have encrusted the heart. And so, the word kapara in the Aramaic means to wipe away. What we are saying to the Almighty is, on Yom Kippur, is that we've regained a certain insight into what we're really all about. In the depth of our character, what are we really all about? You know what, God, we're really all about? We are you. We are your children. We are cut of something celestial, something divine. And to the extent that we have that divine spark, therefore, we wish to re-engage, invoke that spark. We want to assert that aspect of us. And as we take hold of that innermost precious integrity, the Almighty wipes away the crust. He wipes away the soot, the schmutz on top of our souls. And we are once again able to shine forth with the fullness of our inherent being. That's called kapara, mechaper, to wipe away. Those are things that we have discussed in the past. I would like to add to that discussion some other thoughts. And in order to do so, I would like to talk about the inuyim. It says in the Torah text says, v'inisem, and you shall afflict your soul. So on Yom Kippur, we have to afflict. Our sages tell us that the oral tradition defines the afflictions in five ways. Here are the things that we are to afflict ourselves with on Yom Kippur. We are to forego eating and drinking. We fast on Yom Kippur. That's one of the inuyim. We are to forego sexual intimacy with our spouse. That is one of the inuyim. On Yom Kippur, we are not to bathe or to shower or to wash ourselves. On Yom Kippur, we are not to oil ourselves. There used to be, it was very prevalent, it's not very prevalent anymore, except it's in very modest ways, that people used to smear themselves with, anoint themselves with oil. And this, probably like some of the creams today, were things that made a person's skin softer, more pliable, more attractive. Not allowed to do that on Yom Kippur. And the fifth of the inuyim is that we are not to wear leather shoes. And once upon a time, the only alternative was to wear either some wooden klutzes or to walk around in a few pairs of socks. Today, we have the option of putting on sneakers. So we have better protection. But in effect, ne'ilas ha-sandal, putting on shoes, anything that has any leather on it, even if it has leather on the top, some of those sneakers have suede on top, you shouldn't wear that on your tip. Okay, so we understand that these are different ways of afflicting the person. They are ways in which we deny ourselves basic comforts, eating, drinking, bathing, whatever, moisturizing our skin, wearing shoes, or being intimate. Those are all different forms of denial and affliction. And in our Rosh Hashanah, within the context of our Rosh Hashanah discussion, I think it would be very readily apparent how those things would fit in to the requirements of the season. But I'd like to briefly digress and tell you that that Yom Kippur is not the only time in which those afflictions are applicable. There are two other instances. One is on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av essentially has the same halachic requirements. On Tisha B'Av, the day upon which the Beis Hamikdash, the Temple of Jerusalem, was destroyed, we are required to forego those five categories. We are not permitted to bathe, we're not permitted to wear shoes, we're not allowed to eat, we're not allowed to drink, the whole shooting match. And if, God forbid, someone should lose one of their immediate relatives, for which there's an obligation to grieve and to mourn from the standpoint of halacha, so four of the five apply. During the period of mourning, one is not permitted to shower, one is not permitted to wear shoes, one is not permitted to be intimate with his wife. The one that doesn't apply is that you're allowed to eat and drink. You're not required, a person is not required during the period of Shiva to fast. It would be a long fast. In any event, it's not required. But we need to understand, since Tisha B'Av is a time of avelus, it is a time of mourning and grieving, and apparently mourning and grieving of such an intensity that it invokes these five forms of denial, then why is it in fact that there shouldn't be some form of fasting during the period of the Shiva that would provide for that same expression in avelus, and if a person is mourning a loved one? Secondly, is there any relationship, and how can we avoid seeing any relationship between the fact that when our sages determined, because when it comes to Tisha B'Av, and when it comes to the laws of mourning during the Shiva, the forms of denial are of rabbinic decree. They are not mandated by the Torah. The only ones that have any kind of a binding quality from the position of the Torah is Yom Kippur. So we would have to say that somewhere our sages saw a relationship, that there's some relationship between grieving and mourning and Yom Kippur, for which reason they took this set of halachos from Yom Kippur and superimposed them upon the institutions of grieving and mourning. Where did they see the relationship? Yom Kippur does not present itself as it's not a yontif of mourning. There is one place in the Torah, actually two, one in the Torah and one in Scriptures, that we see some sort of a business about removing one's shoes. When Moshe is first confronted by the Almighty in his first prophetic experience, at least the one that's recorded, and there's this burning bush, and he turns to investigate what's going on with this bush that burns and is not consumed. A voice comes out saying to him, Shal ni alecho mi'al raglecho, take your shoes off your feet, ki amoki masharato emid alav admas kredish, because the ground upon which you stand is holy. Take off your shoes. The second time we find that is by Joshua. Yeshua is also confronted by a prophetic experience, and he is told, "Shal na'alcho mi'al raglecho, take your shoe, not your shoes, your shoe off your feet, because this is a holy place." It doesn't speak about holy ground, but it says it's a holy place. We don't find any other prophet or any other Jewish leader who is spoken to by the Almighty who is told that they have to remove their shoes. So there's something here, there's a significance about removing the shoes that applies to Moshe in his new role. So we need to understand what that's all about. I would like to suggest here, as an avenue of thought, that these five Inuyim are representative of five major, perhaps, the only ways in which a person should be defined by others as well as himself. In the broadest possible sense, every person is part of the human community, part of the human race. And while it may be true that not very much of who we are or what we are is defined by the way in which we answer to the human race, nonetheless, there are issues which belong to the fact that we are part of the human race. Issues that apply to the globe. Do we have a position on nuclear power? Do we have a position on the abuse of wildlife in deference to our appetites for ivory or other furs or what have you? Do we have responsibility to lands that suffer from drought and famine? Do we have an obligation to respond to people who are politically oppressed? The list is goes on and on. So there's us as we are part of the world community. Then a bigger portion of us is us in terms of our social context. In other words, the people with whom we interact, our friends, the members of a ethnic community, the ones with whom we deal, both on a local and perhaps national or international level, but people with whom we deal because there are common interests that we share, so we deal with them, we interact with them. So there we deal with stuff such as ways in which we can contribute and ways in which we can actively be helpful. Maybe visiting the sick, or paying a shiva call, or helping out when someone has a baby. It may be playing together, maybe studying together, maybe davening together. It could be lots of things. Working together for Israel Bonds, whatever. I mean, but there is a direct interactive. It's not as vague as the whole world. There's a group, an identifiable social group. The third, which defines even more of who we are, is the way in which we relate to, how we deal with our families. The frequency of our interactions is generally a good deal more than those of the social context, and certainly in feeling we are much closer. And there we have obligations. What am I going to do? How am I going to put myself out? Myself out for my parents, my children, my siblings, what have you. The fourth area of definition is our most intimate social relationship, which is that of a spouse. That defines a great deal of who we are and says a great deal about us. What is the quality of our relationship with our spouse? How much, in fact, do we care? How much do we share? How much of a real partnership is involved here? The goals that we strive for, how much do we enable one another? How much do we support one another? How much do we encourage one another? That is very high profile defining characteristic. We reveal our deepest secrets to a spouse, and to that extent they can be helpful to us in places where we would not dare to expose ourselves to any stranger. And finally, the fifth context is the personal context. The context of ourselves with ourselves. When there's nobody else around, when we have nothing else to answer to but ourselves and God. We're never without God. So there's us in the utter isolation or solitude of ourselves and the Almighty. So there are those five areas: the world community, our immediate social context, our friends with whom we interact, our families, our spouse, and ourselves. When a God forbid, a close relative passes away, all of that entire cluster gets thrown up into the air. It is now a jumble. There are all kinds of definitions, all kinds of questions that need to be confronted, redefined, that we need to ask ourselves and answer. Perhaps the most immediate one is my faith still intact? Am I angry with God? Am I going to reject God? I don't like the way He runs the world. He's tested my faith in whichever way death tests faith. Perhaps I discover upon the absence of the significant other that the only reason that I believed was because that person was there. Now that that person isn't there anymore, I no longer believe. I'm no longer motivated to believe. I no longer have the support to believe. So it invites us to examine that question from the personal sense. What about the fact that a death makes us more mindful of our own mortality, our own weakness, and we are forced to re-examine the fact that perhaps our priorities need to be reordered. Maybe when I suddenly realize how close my own mortality is, even if it's X number of years away, but when I realize how inescapable the end of life is, I change my priorities. I no longer think that this thing is so important. I'm not going to invest so much effort in that area. So that's a question that we ask. We may ask ourselves, and these, by the way, are just sample questions. We may ask ourselves, now that this has happened, do I need my friends more or do I need them less? Or we may ask ourselves the question, where were my friends when I needed them? Which people were there? Which people were not there? There are questions that are generated by the experience. Is there as much comfort or as much reward or fulfillment in socialization or in socializing as there was before? In what ways do I need to work harder to compensate for the loss? Somebody is suddenly missing in the family, maybe a very important person in the family. It may mean that I have to contribute financially in ways. It may mean that I must contribute emotionally more in order to compensate for the absence of that person. I've got to ask myself, where do I stand? What are my new responsibilities in terms of the family? Have I become, as a result of this loss, have I become more dependent? Have I become more dependent, more independent? What's happened to me? There are all kinds of questions, and of course, if there's a loss of great magnitude, such as one in which an entire nation is banished and the citadel of their spiritual expression is razed to the ground, is destroyed. How does this affect my identity now that I am going to be a stranger in a new place? What are my new relationships and responsibilities going to be? So, as a direct reference to those five areas, which are part of the way in which all people define themselves, there are representative, if you will, symbolically, there are five expressions of things that we don't do during the period of mourning, in which we need to examine those questions, in which we need to ask ourselves and answer to these very important questions in our lives. Rechitza. An ovel, a mourner, is not permitted to bathe or to shower. Rechitza is one of the basic prerequisites for a person to somehow to be welcomed into society. The individual who is who doesn't bathe and as a result is both unkempt and malodorous is a person who will not be welcomed into the society of man. And to the extent that they will not be welcomed into the society, to the human race, they remain an outcast. Rechitza represents an act which invites us to examine in what way this death has impacted on the way in which we define ourselves vis-a-vis the world community. Second is sicha. Sicha is when a person creams or oils themselves. Gemara Pesachim says that oil is ma'adein es habosa, that it refreshes, it vitalizes, it beautifies the flesh, the person. And for the world community, that would not be important, but it would be important for those with whom we have some more frequent interaction. Those people who see us, those people before whom we would wish to appear comely, handsome, beautiful. So the absence of sicha for the ones who see us up close invites us to look at our priorities or the ways in which we define ourselves vis-a-vis our more immediate social context. Achila and shtia, eating and drinking, are familial activities. You sit down And generally, we eat as a family. And in the case of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it invites us to examine in what ways this, the impact of this loss affects the ways in which we understand now we have to deal with our family. How has it changed? How is this loss going to manifest itself in terms of our family? Understandably, the sexual relationship, and the absence of that, invites us to examine the most immediate relationship to us, that of our intimacy. How do we change now? Or how must we redefine ourselves in terms of this loss and our intimacy? And finally, Ne'ilas Hasan, the removal of our shoes. Well, there's a lot to be said about that, but the only one that I would like to focus on to, for the purposes of tonight's discussion, is the fact that shoes are the kinds of things that people put on because they want to go someplace. And when we don't want to go someplace, we kick off our shoes. It's a sign that we're ready to stay at home, that we're not going to travel. In order that that we might concentrate on ourselves, who we are, when we are alone, that's signified by the fact that we take off our shoes, and that during that period of time, that the only thing we're concerned about is the place upon which we stand. We. Shalom Yalech Mel Raglech. Moshe, take off your shoes. Kemokim Asher Ata. Omei Dalov, that place upon which you stand. You're not going any place. You've lost your latitude. The only thing that you have now is you. And yet, where you are, you can still travel. You can travel deep down into the depths of your being, or because you have a neshama that's capable of soaring into the heavens, you can travel upward. You can do all of this while you're standing still. And that defines perhaps the most significant part of the person, and that is what the person is when they are with themselves and the Almighty. The difference between, question that we ask, the difference between the laws of mourning for a loved one as opposed to the laws of mourning for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash is that since eating and drinking is something that we would deny ourselves in order to be able to examine how the loss of that loved one impacts upon who we are in terms of our family, if we allow a person to eat and think, the absence of that person at the table, so to speak, invites that very same kind of reflection. You don't need to deny a mourning, the eating and drinking, in order to focus him on the way in which the absence of that person, the family constellation, now impacts on their lives, because there is no more forceful way of directing their attention to him than allowing the person to eat and drink and bring them together, so to speak, at the table. If we were to want to, we might be able to see how the Yomim Tovim in general all correspond to those five areas. Rosh Hashanah is a judgment of the entire world, not only the Jewish people. It's a judgment of the entire world. The entire human race is judged. That's the world community. Shavuos, which identifies us as a small family within the nations, is that which directs our attention to our immediate social circle. Pesach, with its it's Korban Pesach, the Seder, invites us to reflect on the familial Sukkos, Teshvu Ke'en Tadur, the only Yom Tov really of all the Yom Tovim, in which ideally intimacy is permissible and encouraged. A person should sanctify that relationship, even as far as the Sukkah is concerned. And Yom Kippur is the intensely personal, wherein each one of us greets the Almighty as an only child. Now, when we go over from this perspective, on Yom Kippur, when we go over this list of Al Chet, all the things that we find in our, so to speak, our confessional, we will find that all of those things touch upon one of those areas. It either deals with us in relationship to the ways in which we deal with members of the family, in ways in which we've dealt with our friends, in ways in which we've dealt between ourselves and the Almighty. In one way or another, it's a checklist. And it's a checklist which says to us, here's a barometer. You want to figure out how you stand in relationship to these five areas. Go over this list and you will see how you measure up. Now, we would like, on Yom Kippur, we would like to be able to walk away feeling relieved. We would like to walk away feeling that there is forgiveness and that something has happened, that our hearts are lighter, that some of the chains of the past have been released. So there's a Rambam that tells us, explains to us why forgiveness works. He says as follows. U'mishana shemo. He says a person changes his name. He doesn't really change his name. Nobody walks in to Yom Kippur with the name of Shapiro and walks out with the name of O'Leary. But U'mishana shemo changes his name. Kalema, the Rambam says, Maimonides says, Ani acha. I am somebody else. I'm a different person. I'm not the person who did those terrible things that I just talked about. I just finished pounding my heart. I just finished saying, this is the thing that I did, the other thing that I did. And now I'm asking for forgiveness. You know why? Because I'm a different person. That person is no longer here. The person who violated your expectations, your commandments, is now gone. In his place, there's a new person. There's a new name here. There's a new entity. So that's the Rambam's perception of one of the basic, one of the pivotal issues of forgiveness. So how do we let go of this other person? We just finished talking about the things that we did wrong, and now we've got to let go and allow a new person to emerge. How do we let go of that other person? One of the most important things that we can do in letting go, we've already identified. We have to be candid and painfully honest, and we have to say to ourselves, yes, I come up short in area 1, 2, 3, 4. These are symptoms of how I come up short. I am not as attentive to my parent as I should be. I am not as respectful to my spouse as I should be. I am not as responsive to my children as I should be. I am not as mindful of the covet of my friends as I should be. I am not as attentive to my relationship to the Almighty as I should. And that in turn is defined and defined and defined. So we acknowledge what's wrong. We acknowledge where we are weak. But that's not enough. And it's not enough to say to God, I'm sorry. And it's not enough to say to God, I regret it. It's not enough to say to God, I feel terrible about this. It's not even enough to say to God, not only do I feel terrible about it, but I will never again do those things, which are all part of the things that we need to do. Because on top of all of that, what is required is that we be successful. And if what we are going through is a sham, the only one who gets fooled is not God, it's us. And if we're going through a sham, then if what we're looking is to walk away feeling buoyant, free, and liberated, we're not going to feel liberated, because the only one that we've deceived is up here or something, but deep inside of us we know that we're still walking around schlepping the same ball and chain that we walked into Yom Kippur with, because we've done nothing other than to profess the fact that we're contrite. Okay, we're contrite. We've also said that we would like to do otherwise, but we've done nothing about really making it otherwise. And what's required is that the inuyim, that these five different areas be confronted, challenged, and redefined, so that what we are going to ask of them and what we are going to bring to them is going to make it possible for those changes to take root and to be successful. We need to ask ourselves, we've made a goal. Now we have to ask ourselves, okay, I'm sorry about the fact that I did not do enough of, I didn't daven enough, I didn't learn enough, whatever it was, on a personal level. I wasn't as feeling enough. Okay? Now, I'm sorry about that. Not only am I sorry about that, but I'm not going to allow it to happen again. Well, what are we going to change? It's not going to happen on its own. We have to change something. There's a price that's got to get paid someplace. It's going to come out of time. It's going to come out of effort. Somewhere it's going to come out of it. If we want to learn more, if we want to daven better, it's got to come out of something. Where is it going to come from? It may come out of our work. It may mean that we're going to make less money. It may come out of the time that we spend playing racquetball. It's got to come out of someplace. Unless we're going to actively identify the things that are in practice, factual, in reality, going to be different, either in schedule or in some other aspect. Unless we can identify how hard we are willing to work, the ways in which we're going to make it work, then we've gone through a lot of the right motions, but we're not going to be successful. And that is a shortcoming in the effort of tshuva. On an intimate note, we need to ask ourselves, how am I going to enlist my spouse in the support of the goals that I have now espoused? Or, conversely, how am I going to support my spouse in the goals that they should pursue? What can I do to be more helpful to them so that they can become more of what they need to become? What things do we need to change in the family constellation? How do we need to alter the ways in which we spend time, the activities that we do together? How can we become more supportive of one another in that area? We need to identify behaviorally what's going to change in that realm. We need to ask ourselves about our social context. Do we have the right friends? We may have a group of friends who are wonderful, but they may be the wrong friends for our newly espoused goals. We have now taken on some goals in which we've said to ourselves, here's what we want to do with our life. Now we say to ourselves, well, maybe I shouldn't be hanging around with so-and-so, because they're going to schlep me right back into shooting pool.
or whatever. That becomes a serious question. Which social context is going to encourage, support, and make the pursuit of these goals a reality? Or, conversely, what can we do to help our friends become the kinds of people that we know that they would like to become? So unless we go through the exercise of identifying the places that we come up short in each one of these realms, in each one of these areas, whether it's in Rechitza, or it's in Sicha, or it's in Ilas Hasan, wherever it is, unless we can identify what our failures and weaknesses are, and very important, underline and make the structural behavioral modifications that will support our new resolve, nothing will have changed. The only way that something will change is if, in addition to contrition, in addition to resolve, we also deal with the inuyim. We also deal with those five areas of denial. And as we become mindful of what each represents, to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about changing the structure in this area, so that we are, as the Rambam says, that we are acher, we are somebody else. By definition, if we have gone through this exercise correctly, what will happen is that, in fact, we will feel liberated because we will have done a whole job. We will have gone from A to Z. We will have gone from point of departure to destination. And when that happens, there will be something that will be truly liberating, and a new sense of buoyancy will meet us with the conclusion of Yom Kippur. Part of that buoyancy will be the recognition that what has emerged out of this fire of Yom Kippur is a new self. And by definition, no new self appears unless an old self is put to rest. And here I would like to invite the thought that the word lekaper, which means to forgive, to atone, in Hebrew allows for the substitution of letters that are derived from the same place that those other letters are formed. And there's another word, which is lekaber, which means to bury. And lekaper and lekaver are two kindred concepts. We are only forgiven when we have buried the part of ourselves that would restrict our growth. The new self can only emerge when there is this sense that something has been born. And that it is born, by the way, doesn't mean that we haven't learned from our former self, doesn't mean that we're not inspired by our former self, but it does mean that whatever it was that limited, that crippled, that restricted the former self, that self is no longer here. Eini, as the Rambam says, I'm no longer that person. That person has disappeared, God. Whatever decree you've passed against that person is irrelevant, because in its place there is a new person. Aniach, I'm somebody else. So there will be a sense of mourning for the old. It's not like we didn't like the old chap. Old chap is pretty good. It's always hard to part with something that we've worn that long. And frequently, if it happens with some very significant items in our lives, we put them in the attic and we save them. So there is a sense of loss. There's a sense of mourning. And it's from that sense of grieving for the old, which is at once that which also ignites the sense of joy that greets the new. But it's from there that our sages understood that when the Torah defines Yom Kippur as a time that you need these five inuyim to direct our attention to ways in which we can be reborn, a birth that takes place out of a death, that those same areas are equally relevant when a person does anything in the morning. Not only when we mourn the disappearance or the absence of ourselves on Yom Kippur, but when we mourn the disappearance of any person who is close to us, or something of the magnitude of a Beis HaMikdash whose absence changes our lives in a very dramatic way. Perhaps for that same reason, on Yom Kippur, we wear the kittel. The kittel is a symbol of the way in which the Almighty washes us clean. It's a sign of a rebirth. We enter this period of life from Yom Kippur on with a clean slate, white as snow. And at the same time, the kittel is also vaguely reminiscent of that last garment with which we are put to rest. Because it is out of the way in which we put ourselves to rest that the new person emerges, who wears the kittel with a bright, clean slate as a sign that there is something new in its place. So this is Yom Kippur. We are invited to experience the sadness of putting a well-worn shoe to rest and to allow something fresh and vital and new to appear in its place. And that will only be the case not only when we've gone through all of the necessary steps of remorse and contrition on the one hand, resolve for the future on the other hand, and above and beyond that, when we've taken each one of those important areas of life and we've asked ourselves, how must I change within the context of this sphere, of this dimension? What must I restructure practically and behaviorally in order to make every aspect of my surroundings conducive to and supportive to the result that I just made? I want to be successful. I'm not going to be successful on the heels of my remorse. I'm not going to be successful even on the heels of my resolve. In addition to all of that, I must make some tangible changes. And we've made those changes when every one of the inuyim has become manifest in the sense that as we are afflicted by the denial of each one of these things, each one asks of us, and how have you restructured? How have you restructured yourself in terms of your social context? How have you restructured yourself in terms of your family? How have you restructured yourself in terms of your spouse? How have you restructured yourself in terms of you, in the loneliness of you and God? Only when we've answered how, we have, in fact, found a plan, a program, to change things so that our resolve will have the support, will have the time, will have the resources to be successful. Only then will we feel that which Yom Kippur is uniquely qualified to do, equipped to do, and that is to release us from the past and to place in wherever it is that we were standing before, something bright and new and shiny, something that is full of a new source of energy, something that will allow us to go forth to greet the new year with the sense that there is something totally new in its place, something that is not bogged down, dragged down, restricted by whatever the limitations were of the past, but something that is vitalized by this peculiar sense of source of sanctity that is that is peculiar to that divine spark which is invested within each one of us, that allows us to dream about and to reach for that which is celestial and sacred and holy and in heaven. And may the Almighty grant that that we can dream about all those things, and that we can come closer to making them